I'm Nolan Ford, and today I'm joined in the studio by Massachusetts songwriter Heather Maloney. Heather's music first arrived at the NSPR doorstep in the form of an EP titled Woodstock that she recorded accompanied by the folk band Darlingside. The album features a beautiful cover of the classic Joni Mitchell song and showcases Heather's impressive talent as a vocal artist. In addition to this collaboration album, Heather also has a flourishing solo career with three recordings behind her, including her latest release, Making Me Break. We're catching Heather at the tail end of a short West Coast tour before she returns back east to continue promotion of her latest record at a series of summer music festivals. Heather, thanks for coming down today.
Thanks for having me.
How did you first get introduced to music, and when did you know it was something you wanted to pursue professionally?
First introduced to music, wow. I guess my earliest memories of just being really infatuated with music would probably be at around age 6. And my mom let me take her record player and put it in my room. And she was kind of a hippie that didn't have TV in the house or anything. So that was my primary source of entertainment. And so I dug into her records and started jumping on my bed to the Beatles. And then, you know, as I kind of got deeper into her record collection, I started getting into Joni Mitchell and kind of the more like confessional lyric based, like folky 70s stuff. I guess I would really have to credit her to kind of fostering my earliest musical experiences. She really kind of created an environment that could happen within.
Nice. And then when did you know that it was time to start performing and hitting the road?
I always had been a singer. I was the classic sing into your hairbrush girl that just listened to so many singers. I mean, all throughout my childhood and being a teenager in the 90s, I was idolizing, you know, Mariah Carey, and I'm just learning how to sing from these people. And I mean, Christina Aguilera, they're really good singers, and they taught me a lot. And but it was always, you know, that sort of dream that would never happen, you know, the pop star dream that mm-hmm. will never happen. But I didn't start thinking of it as something that could really be a career until I started writing music. And I didn't start writing music until about 4 or 5 years ago. I think that when I started writing songs, I had the first idea that I somehow owed it to myself or the world to share the things that I was writing, and that was when I started booking shows.
Your music has been described with the title adventurous folk, and I was wondering if this is something that you agree with, if you like that, or what that means to you.
Yeah, I really do like that, because I think being a girl with a guitar who listened to a lot of Joni Mitchell, I'm never going to get away from the word folk, but I listen to so much music, and I feel that it seeps its way in probably more unconsciously than consciously, but I have studied a lot of different types of music too. I studied classical operatic vocals for 2 years. I got really into improvisational jazz, and I even did a short stint with classical Indian vocals, and my teenage years loving pop music, and you know, I just feel like there are so many types of music that I've loved historically and still love that I never want to just be like, I'm a folk artist and not have some sort of a crack in the door to be able to do what I want. So I think that maybe the term adventurous folk like roots me down to the ground in the folk world, but like just leaves me a little bit of space to be crazy when I want to.
Well, you made this great album with Darling Side that's partially a tribute to the Joni Mitchell song and partially original material as well. I was wondering how that collaboration came about and how the idea came about to put this album together.
Yeah, with intense serendipity. So many things happened coincidentally for us to make that EP. We had been living and starting our music careers in the same smallish city of Northampton, Massachusetts, about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And we'd heard of each other, and, you know, my friends would say, "Oh, have you seen Darling Side? They're great." And their friends would say, "Oh, you got to go check out Heather." And so we just kind of maybe admired each other from afar for a few years. And then they all moved to Boston, and we ended up kind of, we just never got together. We never did a show. Something happened when they were out there. Some kind of opportunity came up, and we ended up doing a tour together finally. And we went kind of all throughout the Midwest, and we scooped up down through the Southeast back to the Northeast. And so it was a big loop, and we were on the road for maybe 2 or 3 weeks together. And when we were in Chicago on that tour, we played at this woman named Val Haller. She writes for the New York Times, and she had amazingly been a fan of my music. So she said, you know, "Come and play my concert series." And we were like, "Okay, yeah, sure." So we went and we played for her and her group. And sometime after the performance, she says to the audience, "Darling Side reminds me of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Like, their four-part harmonies are, like, just so spot on, and I'm just getting a total CSNY hit right now." And then she said, "And Heather, you've always kind of given me such a strong Joni vibe." So she says, "You know, I want to feature both of you in my column for the Times," she said, "and I just came up with the most brilliant way to do it. You know, you guys do a cover of Woodstock," mm-hmm. "and Joni Mitchell wrote it, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young covered it. It would be the best way to, you know, kind of feature you both." And so, of course, we said yes. So we made the video, and we made the recording, which was recorded live, the video and the audio, at the same time. And she did it. She did the column, and she put Woodstock up there on the Times website. And amazingly, Graham Nash saw the video, and so we all peed ourselves. And then he saw the video, and he mentioned us in a keynote speech that really helped set off a buzz for us to start touring nationwide. I mean, that really was sort of the tipping point for our touring radius to expand to nationwide. And so we jumped back in the van a few months later with this recording, and we played Woodstock all over the country together pretty much for the whole duration of the year last year. It was so much fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, traveling from, you know, the East Coast and the West Coast, I was wondering, you have kind of a unique perspective seeing how your music, and I guess folk music in general, is just digested or encountered as a performer, and also maybe as a music listener. I was wondering if you've noticed anything, any differences in the two different coasts.
That's a really good question, and I want to be so careful about how to answer it, because it's so easy to sound like I'm just stereotyping. But what I love about the Northeast is that there's a lot of singer-songwriters. There are a lot of folk musicians out there. And I think that in general, New England audiences are incredibly discerning. And I think that coming up, that was really tough for me, because I feel as though I had to do a lot of my songwriting growth publicly and kind of make mistakes and have noses turned up at me. But I also think that it was that kind of trial by fire really pushed me to become or to try to become more refined in my songwriting and my lyrics, like knowing that there were people that were going to be a laser beam of attention and, you know, thinking about the words that I'm saying. And so it gave me self-consciousness in a lot of ways, but it also really made me push myself. So I think that maybe is an advantage, like it's a positive quality, positive side to what Northeast audiences are like. And I think that maybe the way that I've found in the West, what the audiences out here are really good at is feeling music. And I'm incredibly emotional. And so I feel like what I'm transmitting even more to audiences out here is more of the unsaid parts of the song, like not you know, the parts that are felt, you know, be they emotional or spiritual or psychological, that they're sort of a little bit more just open-hearted to that. So again, I don't want to be like, they're smart in the East and they're loving in the West. Like, you know, I don't want to like generalize, but I feel like I get a hit of that when I play.
I think that's a really good answer.
Thank you.
I also enjoyed reading about your relationship with meditation and how it helped to inspire some of your early songwriting. I was hoping you could tell our listeners about some of your experiences with that with Vows of Silence, and how meditation affects you and sort of guides your songwriting now.
I ironically didn't start writing music until I had spent a few years living and working at a silent meditation retreat center and in central Massachusetts. And I started, my original motivation for picking up an instrument and writing a song was to sort of do something a step beyond journaling. So I was just having really what felt like life-changing experiences and like defining experiences that felt like they were defining who I was. So I just had this really intense urge to capture those lessons, those insights, those experiences in something more tangible than just a journal, or, you know, I just didn't want those moments to just fly by and not be captured somehow. So I thought maybe I can capture them in song form. And I think I said, like, early on in one of my first interviews, it was the first time in my life that I wanted to get tattoos, because there were things that I was realizing about myself and life and everything that felt so important, that and something that I wanted to keep so badly that I thought I should get them tattooed onto my body so that I would have, you know, it's just this like urge to capture. I think the urge to capture was the like initial motivating factor to writing songs. And so I think that if I hadn't ended up at a meditation center, I don't think I would have ended up a songwriter. Mm-hmm. So that was the initial like push to do it. And then now my life is pretty much the exact opposite of what it was when I was at the meditation center. You know, it was like space, silence, routine. And now I'm constantly changing like time zones. I never sleep on the same pillow. I have absolutely no routine. I don't sit at the same time every single day. My meditation has become a lot more fluid and sort of fragmented and scattered and woven in through my chaotic life. So, and there's a lot more content. There's a lot more stimuli. So, it's almost like the times that I'm writing and the times that I'm performing have become the safe place, like the refuge for me. Mm-hmm. And the times where I really pause the most. So now I think maybe it used to be like this intention to capture what was going on at the meditation center. Now it's like an intention to like duck away from the world for the hour that I'm on stage and get inside of a song and just, you know, do something that fills me up and feeds me.
Mm-hmm. Well, your latest album, Making Me Break, was produced by Bill Reynolds of Band of Horses. And I was wondering what it was like working with a producer for the first time.
Yeah. It felt like something clicking into place. I've kind of co-produced, and the position producer has always been sort of this fuzzy thing. It was never like this decided, planned position, and I think that that changed so much for me, deciding that someone was going to be in that position, and made it kind of feel like a well-oiled machine, and not just like different people in the studio going, well, what about this and that, and then, you know, and I'm just made it really clean and efficient. And Bill, I've been going around singing his praises since the record came out, and since I started telling people about how it went, because he couldn't have been better in that position of producer. He has incredible ideas, and he's not afraid to kind of push bounds of the original vision, but he never once, you know, stepped on my toes or made me feel like his ideas were better than mine, or and I think that with every kind of grand idea that he had and achieved, not once do I feel like the essence of the song is lost, and I've never kind of seen a producer be able to do that, and he's brilliant in that way. He honors the songwriter, you know, and I've felt like it's easy for as a songwriter to sort of give up the essence of the song little by little until the song is so built up and produced that you know, whatever it was is just so gone, and it became something else, which is great, and sometimes that's great, but every single song still feels the same way to me that it did when I sat down to write it alone in my room. And I think one more thing I'd want to add about Bill is that in our first conversation, he kind of, I'm not sure if he used this word exactly. He may have, he may not have, but I remember the sentiment being that he was almost like a midwife to the artist that he's working with.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved how just, you know, gentle and like passive almost, but very active and very necessary. Mm-hmm. And I think that as a producer, if you have the ability to really take that approach to delivering a record, that it, you know, it can result in some magic, and that's what it felt like.
So the album title, Making Me Break, I was wondering what that means to you, and maybe what are some of the recurring themes or ideas throughout the album?
Making Me Break, we never thought that that would be necessarily the title track of the record, just musically, but the song, the sentiment really felt like the center of the record, and so that's why we ended up going with it as the title track. And the song, I wrote it the fall before last. It was a song that sort of sat for a little while, and I was driving through upstate New York. I was on my way to Syracuse, and it was like fall. I think maybe it was like November, and it was kind of a windy night, and there were a lot of leaves like going across the road, and so many times on that drive, like, slammed on my brakes because I thought one of the leaves was an animal. It was like rolling and scurrying in such a way that it really looked like a mouse or a squirrel or something. And so I just kept, you know, breaking for these leaves. And so this line came in my head, like, you know, everything is making me break. And the line just sort of like, you know, reverberated in my own brain. And I was like, whoa, you know, okay, that has to be something. And then at the time, I really was kind of going through a pretty rough, like, emotional time. So I felt really fragile. And I felt like anything, the slightest wind would just, like, tip me over. And I felt like a fragile person. So there were so many ways in which that line was working for me. And so I was driving and just singing into my iPhone, into the voice recording thing. And most of the song was written, you know, like, on that drive. And it ended up really capturing what that year and a half was for me, which was just going through a lot of stuff and like childhood stuff just unearthing itself. And I felt raw for like that whole year and a half. And I felt like life was just presenting me with challenges that I was, you know, hopefully going to face and become stronger through. But I was really in the middle of the storm and not really sure if I was going to, you know, get to the other side. And so that the whole record really came, all of those songs really came right out of the center of that storm.
And let's see. I was going to ask about one of your favorite tour memories, but I kind of like that story that you just told. Kind of kind of lays out the, you know, sort of the theme of the album. So I guess we'll just jump right into like the songs and talking about those, what you're going to play today. What songs are you playing for us today, and what can you tell us about them?
All right. So I'm going to play for you this song called Day With You, and it's one of the later songs in the record. And it's a love song, and I wrote it in Central Oregon over the summer when I was on the road with Darlingside. I was really missing a special someone back home, but simultaneously surrounded by some of the most beautiful nature I've ever seen. So I had this real mix of just being in love with my surroundings. You know, I was staying on this piece of land that had lakes that were inverted volcanoes, collapsed volcanoes, and like some of the bluest blues I've ever seen. And you know, the trees in Oregon are just magical. And and at the same time, I was several weeks into this tour and just so homesick. So I this song, it's a love song that really takes a lot of inspiration from nature, and there's a lot of minor chords in it because I'm just missing someone really badly. And but I think that there's brighter parts of the song too, so I think it really reflects my time there. So I'm gonna play Day With You, and the other song I'm gonna play is 1855, I think. 1855, and that is that's a song that is set obviously in the 1850s, and it's also a love song. It's a song about a couple who live almost their whole lives before getting one photograph taken. And I wrote it because it dawned on me one day that there are actually people who existed that only had a couple photographs of themselves in their lifetimes, and that maybe some of those people only had photographs of themselves as older or elderly people, and how how we treasure those photographs of our youths so much more than, like, I mean, we're so documented now. We have, like, thousands of pictures of ourselves. But those pictures that we have, like, the proof that we were young once are so treasured, and that there's people who existed that never had that, and they have no proof that they were once young. And I just thought, you know, those people need a song. And so that's where 1855 came from.